You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Outside Los Angeles City Hall, renters have gathered for a big rally.
It's a pleasure to be here.
There's been a lot of these gatherings lately as renters fear eviction amid the pandemic and economic downturn. Victoria Enriquez is out here watching the speeches. She's a petite older woman who speaks forcefully about her predicament. Before the pandemic, she cleaned homes and was a street vendor. She is the family breadwinner, and she's the guardian of her 17-year-old grandson. When COVID hit, Enriquez lost all her work.
Yo tengo 32 años en este país porque yo siempre pagaba mi renta.
She says she's lived in the U.S. for 32 years and has always paid her rent on time. She's embarrassed to be struggling now. Her landlord has been pestering her for rent money. Now he's trying to get her to leave.
Nada más me pidió y en septiembre me dijo que ya quería el apartamento.
She says in September, he told her he needed the apartment returned back to him. A May UCLA study estimated that more than 400,000 Angelenos have been unable to pay all of their rent during the COVID-19 pandemic because of income loss. 400,000. Now, those renters have been protected from eviction by an array of federal, state, and local laws. Rather than making tenants and landlords feel more secure, however, the multiple layers of constantly changing rules have confused tenants and spiked their anxiety. And advocates say that tenants are still vulnerable to a mass wave of evictions in the future, unless stronger protections are passed. Here's reporter Phoenix So with the latest.
A group of renters and activists protested recently in front of Stanley Mosque Courthouse in downtown LA, attempting to prevent landlords from filing eviction cases inside. One of the protesters was Emmanuel Limaco, a civil engineering student at Cal State LA. When the COVID-19 pandemic started, he was living in a single-family home in Sunland Tujunga with his father, stepmother, and his brother, who has cerebral palsy and is in a wheelchair.
With his non-ambulatory state, we really don't have very many options as far as other forms of housing. You know, the house, it's big, it's wide, he has a ceiling hoist mounted in his room, and the shower was specifically made for him, so we can give him roll-in and roll-out showers in his wheelchair.
Limaco's father supported the family with a business that specializes in commercial and political advertisements. That changed after an accident in January.
My dad had a fall at his work. He was in his warehouse. He fell backwards on concrete and broke his spine in two places. And he went to the hospital, and the surgery went great. He had everything fixed, and he was expected to, come out within, a couple of months. But then coronavirus happened, and it slowed his progress way down. He ended up spending 5 months in the hospital from start to end. And about a month or so before he finally passed, he contracted coronavirus in one of the rehabilitation homes that he was in, trying to do physical therapy. So he passed away.
No one else in the family had a job. Limaco himself was taking college classes after he served 4 years in prison for gang activity.
I lived in Bakersfield for a long time because of the crimes that I committed. I went to prison, and when I was released from prison, I wasn't able to come back home. And even while I was there in Bakersfield, I started going back to school there. It's really the culmination of the amount of work that I've put in ever since I got out of prison for, committing crimes when I was younger.
Now, not only has he lost his father, he has the added stress of keeping a roof over his brother and stepmother's head by paying $2,500 in monthly rent. The family's landlord has been understanding.
I told him, I'm not going to kick you out. Get this thing together. You need help. You need a lawyer. You need to get assistance. You need a lot of things. And you know what? The young man did an amazing job pretty quickly.
This is Ray Peters, who owns the family's home.
He put things together, and he's already paid back all of the past due rent that he owes. So I'm very happy that he was able to, get them back on their feet.
Limico said that even though he didn't think he'd be evicted during the pandemic, he still didn't want thousands of dollars hanging over the family that would need to be paid back someday.
I'm stuck now, you know, being the only one taking care of the household. I don't make any money. The only thing that I do have coming in is my financial aid, which I'm supposed to be using for school purposes. But now I've already wasted more than half of that, you know, just trying to pay the rent off that we had been owing for a few months.
The irony is that because of COVID-19, tenants are now more protected than ever by multiple laws designed to keep them housed even if they can't pay rent. Here's the head of the Eviction Defense Network, Elena Pop.
Overall, tenants right now are better off and safer than they were pre-COVID in terms of housing security.
The trouble is, tenants have to navigate multiple laws that interact in unclear ways. Are they subject to a state law that keeps their case out of eviction court if they pay 25% of their rent between September and January, but then requires them to pay in full again after that? Or are they protected by local measures, such as the City of LA eviction moratorium, which allows residents to defer all rent until after the pandemic is over?
All the laws that protect them are another month and another month there and little bits here. And it's a patchwork of laws that is very hard to understand. So stress, the sense of housing insecurity is way up for people.
Legal evictions are actually down. From April 6th through June, landlords in Los Angeles County filed an average of around 350 legal eviction cases a month, an almost 90% decrease from last year, according to preliminary data from the Superior Court. Illegal evictions, on the other hand, those are up. Landlords lock tenants out, shut off utilities, and call the police in order to get them to move. Pop and her team are seeing about four times as many of those incidents as they saw last year. They are also getting more reports of harassment. Victoria Enriquez, who you heard from earlier, is dealing with such harassment. She says the landlord wants her out and makes a mess outside to try and get her to leave. Daniel Uchelson of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles says that while there are some bad actors among landlords, the majority are only trying to negotiate with their tenants so that both parties can survive through the pandemic.
We want to house people in our community. We want to work with our tenants if they're having trouble paying the rent. An eviction process is a last resort.
He contends, however, that most protections are skewed toward tenants and that landlords have little means of collecting rent they need for mortgages and daily expenses. He'd like to see legislation that includes means testing or tying unemployment payments to rent, as well as mortgage forbearance so property owners get a break, too. Landlord Ray Peter says any solution should take landlord circumstances into account.
Not all landlords are self-sufficient without their income. Fortunately, you know, I'm an older man, you know, and I've built enough of a nest egg to get me through tough times. But there's landlords that might rely on their own livelihood for that. So the bottom line is there are laws, there are rights. And, you know, both sides should have their rights. And if a landlord decides that they need that income, I believe there should be some legal opportunities for them to do so.
Renters, meanwhile, are pushing hard for protections that last longer and make their lives more secure. Here's Emmanuel Limico again.
If the federal government is able to pass an economic stimulus package, what good is that money going to do the economy if people are just going to spend the money on rent? If they're able to pass an economic stimulus package from Washington, I fully believe that they're able to pass a rent cancellation package as well. And in that legislation, take care of landlords at the same time.
In the meantime, renters in Los Angeles and in cities across the country continue to protest, worried that an eviction tsunami could come when the pandemic is finally over. For KCRW, I'm Phoenix So.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Has space always called out to you, but you never got around to applying to NASA's astronaut program? Well, you might still have a shot at getting into one of those cool spacesuits and riding a rocket, at least as far as low Earth orbit, that's about 1,200 miles up. It's going to cost you, though. Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, based right here in Greater LA in Hawthorne, successfully delivered 4 astronauts last night to the International Space Station. It's the first time a private company has ferried space travelers to the station. So then what's the possibility that a private company will then take private citizens, not career astronauts, paid customers, up to the station for a visit? Neil Patel is space reporter for the MIT Technology Review, and he's with us to talk about it right now. Hey, Neil.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm all right. This isn't theoretical anymore, right? A company called Axiom Space is actually announced a private trip up to the space station. What do you know about that?
Well, not much. What we do know is that Axiom Space has contracted a launch with SpaceX to send a private mission to the International Space Station, and that they have also been in touch with NASA to ensure that, you know, the crew will be able to stay there for at least 10 days and, you know, do whatever it is a private crew is able to do on the ISS.
Let's unpack that, Neil, because you said a mission. What could a mission be for, you know, I mean, I would assume some high rollers who have some money to spare in their pockets.
Right. Well, Axiom, we do know that Axiom Space has been in touch with NASA about a possible film project on the International Space Station. And apparently it involves big names like Tom Cruise and director Doug Liman. We don't know if that's going to be the mission that's set to launch next year. What we do know for next year is that there's 2 of the crewmates have been confirmed on this 4-crew mission, a former astronaut named Michael Lopez Alegria and a former Israeli fighter pilot. So those are the only 2 names that have been confirmed so far. Maybe they include Tom Cruise and company, maybe not. None of that is really confirmed yet.
I would imagine, Neil, that a seat on a capsule attached to a rocket that's headed out into Earth's orbit isn't like, say, a drive to Yosemite. How much does something like that cost?
So right now, the flights that SpaceX has contracted with NASA to take astronauts to the ISS, it's about $55 million per seat. And NASA is also spending about $90 million per seat to have Boeing take up astronauts to the ISS when its capsule, Starliner, is finally ready to do so.
I'd also imagine that the space station is no Holiday Inn. I mean, how much to park it there for a night?
Well, actually, it's a little bit cheaper. NASA's not exactly in the process of trying to make money off of something like this. The point of opening up the ISS to private opportunities like this is to just give a leg up to the commercial industry to kind of, you know, use that as a launching point to send people into space, get their space legs, so to speak, and get used to things. They're only going to be charging about, I think it's about $35,000 a night, and that really just covers the cost of life support and, you know, any kind of day-to-day resources on board the station.
How big is it, Neil? I mean, is there enough room for all these people, or?
So the station itself, just by length, is about the length of a football field. Now, that doesn't mean that they have an entire football field of area to roam around. Every part of the station is a sort of close-quartered thing, a lot of different sort of capsules attached to one another. You're right. There is not a whole lot of room to go around. It's a very tight-knit environment for obvious reasons. You have to be very, very used to the idea of spending days, weeks, months, possibly years up on an isolated environment like that and make sure you're not going stir crazy, making sure you're getting enough exercise through some of the equipment they have up there, and just generally acclimating to life in a sort of microgravity environment.
Are they doing anything to make it more hospitable for people to stay there, or for space tourism? You know, you mentioned the workout, right? I mean, maybe there's a gym there.
On the ISS, I can't imagine that being the case. I believe the accommodations on the station are just going to be pretty much what astronauts right now are used to. What we might see later on, though, is in the ability to be able to have people staying on there and getting used to thinking about what more ordinary people might need for, you know, shorter stays in space. The idea is to apply those lessons to, you know, broader kinds of ideas of space hotels and smaller stations that are much more amenable to ordinary people, regular people who just want to stay up in space for a week or so and just get a feel for things, assuming they have the money.
So like a space B&B, right?
Right. So yeah, and you know, that's sort of the goal from having SpaceX run these sorts of missions, is getting used to the idea of sending other private astronauts into space, staying in these private space stations, and creating a market for people to, you know, travel up there and spend some time up there, whether it's for research, whether it's for pleasure, etc.
And by the way, I mean, it's an international space station, so there are many countries that are involved in this. I know Russia is involved in it, so is the United States. But there are other countries that you have to sort of get, I don't know if you get permission, but everybody's got to be on, no pun intended, on board with this, right?
Basically, yes. The weird thing about the ISS, it's divided into kind of two segments. One is sort of led by NASA, but also includes Canada, Europe, Japan. The other side is basically owned and operated by Russia. I would assume that when it comes to, you know, opening up the ISS to kind of to visitors like this, it's going to be on the NASA side. By and large, everyone has to be in agreement, but because NASA is kind of the leader of the of space when it comes to these kinds of things, they can kind of just decide on their own. And unless there's some really harsh objections, the other parties are just kind of going to go along with it.
This really is a story about SpaceX and in the latest maneuver to get those astronauts to the space station. And I want to talk a little bit about, because it's a local company based in Hawthorne, what it means for SpaceX. I mean, it's an expensive endeavor. They're spending a lot of money. It's a privately held company, by the way. You can't buy shares in it. Is it profitable? And is this sustainable for SpaceX?
That's a great question. There's no question right now. SpaceX is not exactly making a profit out of any of this stuff. They've made tremendous strides, and especially with their work in the Falcon 9 rocket, which is reusable. You know, we've seen this for many years now, watching a first stage booster come back to Earth, landing on the ground or on a drone trip in the ocean. Those things have gone a long way into helping to reduce the price of spaceflight. But they're still not at a point where they're sort of making money. But the hope is that things like the Crew Dragon and more operations like this collaboration with Axiom are going to incentivize more and more people to think about going into space and help open up a market. SpaceX, it should be noted, right now, you know, their main customer is NASA, but that's not always going to be the case. They could very just as easily work with other nations to send their astronauts into space. They could work with more private companies who are, you know, perhaps looking to run some experiments or do some tech demos and contract some missions out of them. There's a lot of potential for the market. It's just really a matter of seeing who's going to bite. And I think more importantly, who has the money to bite.
Neil Patel, space reporter over at MIT Technology Review. Neil, thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Americans of Indian descent here in LA and Indians all around the world celebrated Diwali this past weekend. The Festival of Light celebrates the triumph of good over evil, light over darkness, hope over despair. And it has a special resonance this year because an Indian American, California Senator Kamala Harris, is now vice president-elect. Anita Shabria writes for the LA Times. She's written about Diwali and its special meaning this year. Anita, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
2020, obviously, of all years, has been different in so many ways for all of us, for that matter. The pandemic, the shutdowns, the election. It feels like the list could just go on and on. Tell us what you've been hearing from people in the Indian American community about why this year seems different in their celebration.
You know, I think there's really two levels to that. I think across the Indian community, regardless of their political affiliations, there's a real sense of pride in Kamala Harris and the fact that someone from, you know, the subcontinent has reached this levels of American politics. You especially see that in the women and the kids, especially young girls, are just really excited to see her where she is. But then I think for those who favored the Democratic ticket, those who voted for the Biden-Harris team, there's a real sense of starting their new year in a different direction, in a place that they feel more positive than they have in recent times.
There's also a higher profile Indian American on the GOP side in Nikki Haley, right? The former governor of South Carolina, the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. How much has her high profile helped attract Indian Americans to the Republican Party?
You know, I think it's interesting. Indian Americans, I think, are seeing themselves across the political spectrum in this moment. And really, there is no one monolithic block when it comes to South Asians. It's such a diverse continent and so many diverse viewpoints that translates into politics. But absolutely, she's a rising star on the GOP side, someone whose name you've heard, you know, as a possible presidential contender in the future. And I think there's a lot of excitement for some Indian Americans around her as well.
Let's get back to Diwali, because for anyone who is not familiar, what happens in this celebration? I mean, it's not just a, hey, we're going to take a moment and you know, and close our eyes and celebrate what's going on, hope over despair and things like that. There are actual things that happen, right?
It does. Actually, it's a festival that runs over about 5 days. And each day there's different ceremonies that take place, different gods that are honored, different things families do. But it's very much a family-centered holiday. And it's about welcoming in good fortune and good thoughts and good energy into your home and into your lives for the coming year. So you see people lighting candles to welcome the goddess Lakshmi into their home, lighting the little oil lamps. We do beautiful sand designs or patterns on the ground, and you see that artwork. A lot of eating takes place, a lot of sweets. That's a big part of the holiday, is exchanging sweets and gifts of sweets with other families. But really, it's a moment to be grateful and thankful and to look forward with intent in bringing goodness into your life in the coming year.
But alas, here we are in a big pandemic. People are not gathering, or they're certainly not advised to gather. How do you do that in COVID-19?
Well, Diwali is a huge party. I mean, it is when families and communities come together. And so that is very difficult, I think, for the Indian community. But I think that you're seeing the Indian community do it just like everyone's going to have to do it at Thanksgiving, through Zoom, through smaller intimate gatherings, through just being cautious in this very strange and difficult moment.
A lot of the reason, Anita, why people are celebrating has to do with the traditional Hindu stories about the triumph of good over evil. Tell us a little bit about those stories.
Well, two of the main stories are about Rama and his wife Sita, and another Indian hero and his battle over demons. But really, both of them share in common the idea that there was an unjust evil in the world that was overcome or defeated by the hero. And so those are the main themes of the holiday, is setting the world to right, overcoming injustice, using knowledge and goodness to overcome darkness and evil.
Is there special meaning, do you think, with the fact that, that you know, as far as Democrats go, that there is this sort of change in political direction?
I absolutely think, from the folks that I spoke to who are very staunch Democrats, that this electoral win really resonates with the message of the holiday for them, that they see a Biden-Harris presidency as taking the country in a direction that they feel good about, and that parallels the holiday for them. Definitely has some special meaning there.
Anita Chabria, who covers state politics for the LA Times, and for us today, talking about Diwali and the celebration that just passed here in California and all around the world. Anita, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
That's going to do it for us today. Whatever you're celebrating today, go for it. Sunshine, cooler temperatures, the holidays. Speaking of which, what's your plan for Thanksgiving? You know, gatherings outside your household are a big no-no. So what do you have in mind? Keeping it pretty chill? Trying not to eat everything within reach? Yeah, that's a tough one for me, too, in addition to battling demons. Reach out to us at kcrw.com/Thanksgiving. And while you're there, surf on over to the Greater LA page and subscribe to the podcast like so many Angelinos are doing. Once again, kcrw.com/Thanksgiving. Tomorrow, surfing in Palm Springs. Jenna Cagle, Kevin Tidmarsh, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Ray Guarna, Phil Richard, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis, thanking you for your ears. Have a great night.